Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion about politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Political and national security policy analyst Gareth Porter joins us this time to talk about two recent stories, a December 15th piece on U.S. politics in Iraq. He says the U.S. no longer seeks the defeat of Sunni insurgents, and a December 26th piece warning that the U.S. Shiite struggle could spin out of control. You can read his analysis in Interpress News Service at ipsnews.net. Gareth Porter, welcome to Talk Nation Radio. You've been writing some interesting stories lately. Here's one, U.S. no longer seeks defeat of Sunni insurgents. Explain.
Yes, what's been happening here is very interesting. Since the mid to late November, the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Command in Iraq have both sent signals publicly indicating that their attitude toward the Sunni insurgents has changed dramatically, and that they now are ready to talk with them as not just, the implication is not just people to be basically discouraged and defeated, but rather as forces who could be useful allies, in effect, against the real enemy, by implication, that is the Al-Qaeda forces in Iraq. And one of the signals, perhaps the most interesting signal, was on December 8th, when the spokesman for the U.S. command, General Rick Lynch, I think it's Major General Rick Lynch, essentially said that we are trying to defeat the Al-Qaeda forces militarily and to disrupt the Sunni insurgents' forces, and that the major way that we disrupt their forces is through political engagement, quote-unquote. That is, the term political engagement is in quotes. And if you put that alongside a statement from Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, that he was prepared to talk with the insurgents the previous week, then you begin to see, if you put those side by side, or one on top of the other, rather, you see that what is happening here is that the administration is, in fact, positioning itself in Iraq to actually have serious talks with the insurgents. Now, the other signal that Khalilzad gave, which, again, indicates that these talks are not just talks with an enemy, but talks with a group that has the potential actually to be on our side, is that Khalilzad referred to the Sunni insurgents as nationalists, whereas previously the administration always referred to the Sunni insurgents as anti-Iraq forces or anti-Iraqi forces. So, you know, this is like a 180-degree change in the rhetoric, in the terminology being used for the Sunni insurgents. And, you know, that simply cannot be without extremely important political significance.
Now, Iraq's always been a difficult place to cover, with the U.S. presence there anyway. How does this make that even more complicated?
Well, I think it makes it more complicated in the following sense, that the administration clearly is playing a double game, a two-sided or two-level game. On one hand, it is continuing to talk about victory as its primary theme in relation to Iraq, although, you know, the definition of victory is increasingly vague and left to the imagination, I think, of the audience. But on the other hand, the administration is now pursuing a second line of strategy, which, you know, admittedly, it's unclear exactly how far and how fast this is going to go. And one person I spoke with in the Pentagon suggested that nothing was going to happen on this diplomatic front or this political negotiation front with the Sunni insurgents, until after a new government is formed. And that may well be. It may not be something that's going to develop very, very rapidly. So I think it's going to be more complicated, because this second line of strategy I think is going to take a while to develop. It's going to be in the background, and it's going to be difficult to cover it because very little, if anything, will be evident on the record to mark the progress or the development of that line of strategy. So from the point of view of media coverage, you're not going to get much of any, if any, coverage at all on this. But it is going to be there in the background.
Now, I would imagine that the Sunni leaders that are in some way negotiating with the White House might want to make it public, right?
Well, that's correct. That if there is a break of any kind, if there is an agreement to actually sit down between the Ambassador Khalilzad, and Sunni insurgent leaders, that they will certainly want to make sure that becomes public. It is in their interest to do so. On the other hand, the administration is going to be much more wary about that, and that is going to be one of the factors that probably is going to slow this down and make it more difficult to begin the actual process of formal talks between them. But yes, it'll be impossible to keep these secret, I would suggest, simply because it shows from the point of view of the insurgents that they are being recognized by the administration as interlocutors, and that boosts their prestige within Iraq and gives them more bargaining power more generally.
Now, didn't the Kurds ultimately capture Saddam Hussein? I thought I read a story that faction really was responsible for finding him. If that's the case, now we're going to see the Sunnis possibly turning over Abu Musab al-Zarqawi?
Well, that would certainly be a logical endpoint of any agreement that might be reached between the Bush administration and the Sunni insurgents, because this is obviously what the big payoff is for the United States. I mean, there are two payoffs. One is obviously an end to the insurgency, the insurgents laying their arms down. And the other one is that it would could result in the not just the turning over of Zarqawi as a person, as an individual, but in fact the cooperation of the leaders of the insurgency in finding hideouts, in actually rounding up whole networks. So, you know, going much farther beyond the simply Zarqawi himself. And for the administration, I mean, that is really the more important payoff because, I mean, they can, in a sense, I think they believe that they can live with an insurgency going on for quite a while, except for one thing, and that is that it doesn't help them solve the Zarqawi al-Qaeda network problem in Iraq, the terrorist haven problem. They need, it's arguable that they need the assistance of the Sunni insurgents to accomplish that goal. And in fact, in terms of most Americans, I mean, that is the real legitimate interest the United States has in Iraq. If they have any at all, it is to try to end that terrorist haven in Iraq.
Now, that leaves America, again, in a different position with the Iraqi people overall, where it comes to the U.S. presence remaining to protect oil fields, remaining to do reconstruction, and to maybe continue on with the privatization of Iraq.
Well, I think that if the United States, you know, did, in fact, reach an agreement here, there would almost certainly have to be the involvement of the Shiites in some way in that agreement. Because here's the problem. The Sunnis are not going to be willing to lay down their arms if the Shiites are continuing to send in death squads and Shiite commandos and Kurdish commandos into their cities and into the surrounding countryside to round up insurgents or suspected insurgents and put them in prison and torture them, in many cases, to death. I mean, that simply isn't going to happen. But that much is clear. So if there is to be an agreement under which the insurgents do, in fact, lay down their arms, it is going to have to also involve some serious concessions by the Shiite government. And that's why we now come to the second story, which is that the administration has been now increasingly becoming desperate to do something about the Shiites being willing to share some power with the Sunnis and with secular Shiites, that is, the Shiite militants, willing to share power with Sunnis and with secular Shiites as well, and particularly to get the Shiite militants to give up their control over internal security, that is, those militiamen who are carrying out death squad activities and torture houses, and commandos who are using questionable tactics, albeit in many cases, the same tactics that the U.S. troops have used themselves in Iraq. So in the desperation to actually get some traction in getting agreement between the Shiites and Sunnis, well, the United States is now beginning to put pressure on the Shiites in a way that they have not previously. And interestingly enough, this turning point in U.S. policy to put much greater, heavier pressure on the Shiites coincides with the turning point in the declaratory policy, the rhetorical policy, toward the Sunnis. It happened roughly in mid-November, just about a week about 10 days or so before the first sign of a shift in U.S. policy toward the Sunnis. So I find that to be a very interesting sort of coincidence. I don't think it is a coincidence. I think, in fact, that this reflects a much broader shift in administration policy, which is the result of a lot of jawboning of the White House by both Khalilzad and by the U.S. military command, who understand that it's not, you know, the strategy was not working as it was being pursued prior to that, and that something new has to be tried.
Now, Gareth, when you wrote your piece, The Third Option in Iraq, a Responsible Exit Strategy, that was in the fall issue of Middle East Policy, did you foresee this next story of yours, which is U.S. no longer seeks defeat of Sunni insurgents? Listeners, that's in the December 15th Interpress News Service.
No, I did not actually certainly anticipate anything this soon. My assumption was that the route out of Iraq would have to involve congressional activism on the issue, that there would have to be a shift in congressional viewpoints, which would result in an alternative policy being put on the table, and that would be then a way of putting pressure on the White House to shift its policy. Instead, the initiative appears to have come from the embassy, from Ambassador Khalilzad primarily, and perhaps the U.S. command secondarily. So I think that's a very interesting development, which I certainly did not anticipate, and I think it shows it reflects the fact that there is a much greater, what I would call desperation, a sense of desperation in Baghdad on the part of the U.S. Presence there about the way things have been going, and that they are in turn putting some pressure on the White House to be more responsive to reality, and in fact, to get the White House to join the reality-based community.
In that respect, let's turn to a few of the headlines about Iraq. We did hear recently that the finance minister of Iraq, a different Alawi right now, was on the air in America talking about changes that might mean paying back some of the debt that was incurred during the early 90s with the Iran-Iraq war. And there was discussion by him of an increase in oil prices, which brings us to the real deep part of our discussion, which is who will control the oil negotiations with America if America is now talking with so many different factions.
Yeah, I'm sorry, and I didn't address that in my previous rather long-winded answer. But what I was going to say, what I eventually would have gotten to, is that should there be an agreement under which the United States would withdraw its forces. And my feeling is still very strongly that any agreement between the Sunni insurgents and the United States would indeed require a commitment by the United States to a timetable for withdrawal. So should an agreement be reached, the United States is not going to be calling the shots on oil or much of anything else. And indeed, I would argue that we already have gotten to the point now where the United States is no longer calling the shots with regard to any significant issue in Iraq. I mean, they are in a position to obstruct on specific issues. They still have the ability to exert some pressure, but there are limits to how much pressure they can exert. And they can no longer simply tell the Shiite-dominated Iraqi government what to do. And I think we're going to see that on this issue of control over the Ministry of Interior, which is the crux of the struggle now going on between the United States and the militant Shiite leadership. Shiite leaders are going to resist this pressure because they regard control over the Interior Ministry, which means control over the police and control over the militia units which are carrying out these counterinsurgency activities, the death squads, the torture houses, and so forth, as necessary to ensure that the Shiite regime remains in power. They are very, very defensive about that. They believe that control over the means of violence, state organs of violence, is in fact the way that you stay in power. And they learned that lesson from Saddam Hussein himself. So it's going to be very, very difficult, and I would say really impossible for the United States to force the Shiite leaders to agree to give up power over the means of violence in their own government. And that means really that if the United States wants to push that issue to its limit, they're going to have to put the U.S. troop presence on the table. And I think if they do that, there's a very good chance that the Shiites will then say, fine, take your troops out. And they'll say, we will ask the Iranians for assistance, and they will be happy to give us assistance. And I think that is, in fact, the case. So I think the United States has, in fact, lost the leverage that it may have thought it had, and many of us thought it had, and myself included, in the past year or so, that the situation has changed now to the point where the United States, influence, the United States pressure, ability to pressure, has declined quite precipitously. So that means that on issues of oil pricing, the future is not very bright for those who would hope for or the ability to control that kind of issue.
Now, Gareth Porter, about your piece December 26th in Interpress News Service, we've been touching on the first portion of that story, but let me just turn to the portion of it that does have to do with the torture houses you say are being run by Shiite officials in the Ministry of Interior at various locations in Baghdad. To what extent could the international community now apply pressure under the circumstances of the change in the U.S. status in Iraq? Could the international community apply pressure to stop torture in Iraq and to bring about some implementation of human rights standards?
Absolutely. I think now the situation has shifted so that issue is very much front and center in the politics of Iraq as well as the politics of U.S. policy toward Iraq. And this makes international pressure all that much more effective in comparison with the situation before the United States came forward. And as I point out in my article, the United States knew about these torture houses for months, and I would say beginning in early 2005, they began to get reports not just from the media, or from human rights groups inside and outside Iraq, but from their own military personnel who were actually visiting these torture houses. And this has been documented by a U.S. Army doctor who was in Baghdad and surrounding areas until June of this year, and who said that he and military police visited the torture houses and actually reported evidence of torture and other mistreatment in those detention facilities to up the U.S. Command chain of command. So there's no doubt that the information was available, and it was only when, as I say, there was a decision, sort of a high-level decision made to shift the policy that this issue was raised publicly. But now that it has happened, I think this makes it incumbent on human rights activists as well as anti-war activists to really make a great deal out of this issue of torture and death squads as well, because they are controlled by the Ministry of Interior, and because that is now a central issue in the politics of Iraq.
Now, I do want to mention U.S. politics, but before we talk about that, you describe the situation between Iyad Alawi, the former prime minister of an interim government in Iraq, as being in a state of conflict with other Shiite party leaders.
Right.
They were not necessarily for radical de-Baathification, you say, or secret Iranian financing of Siri and Dawah candidates.
Yes, Iyad Alawi was very much in line with U.S. policy when he was interim prime minister from June of 2004 until May of 2005. And he was, in fact, his defense minister was publicly accusing the Shiite, militant Shiite parties of being essentially those people who were running for election in the January 2005 election as being what he called the Iranian list. So the conflict over their Iranian ties was particularly acute during that period of the interim government. And, of course, the Shiite militants on their side regarded Alawi as essentially their enemy, more aligned with the Sunnis, and because Alawi himself is an ex-Baathist, although he's a secular Shiite, he was part of Saddam's Baathist structure. And then when he left, he became aligned with the CIA and was trying to overthrow Saddam. But he does have a Baathist background, and he's very much considered as part of the Baathist enemy by the militant Shiites. So it's not just the Sunni insurgents and the Sunni politicians who are aligned with the insurgents, but the Shiite secularists as well, like Alawi. Particularly Alawi, who are regarded as enemies by the current ruling parties in Iraq.
I'd like to know what could develop politically between some of the major political figures in Iraq, those who lean towards supporting the Kurds, those who lean towards including the Sunni parties in a more consensus government. I'd like to ask you about the Kurds, because at this point we are starting to see commercials for the other Iraq, and these are requests for investment into the other Iraq, which is Iraqi Kurdistan.
Well, this is very interesting. I mean, you're right. The Kurds are going to play a very important swing role in the politics of in the next few months as the parties maneuver around formation of a new government in Baghdad. The Shiite list, the UIA, has a majority but does not have enough to form a government, presumably, without certainly the Kurds on their side, without aligning the Kurdish members of parliament with the UIA, the militant Shiite parties. So they do need the Kurds in order to form a government. Now, the Kurds are very, very close to the United States. I mean, the United States is essential to the Kurdish strategy for maintaining at least its autonomy if not de facto independence, and the autonomy that they want and that they've achieved is in fact de facto independence. So the United States will undoubtedly try to use the Kurds to put pressure on the Shiites to get them to give up their control over internal security. And that's going to be where the rubber hits the road in the coming weeks and months, is that struggle where the Kurds will be under pressure from the United States to go along with this demand, to make that demand as a condition for forming a government. The Sunnis will be trying to resist that and essentially warning the Kurds that if they insist on this, that there will be a political crisis and there's no guarantee about how it will be resolved. And so you can see, I mean, the title of my article was that the U.S. Shiite struggle could spin out of control. And there is a degree of uncertainty here about how that's going to play out. But the Kurds are definitely going to be inclined to go along with the U.S. in trying to pressure the Shiites. But I see a real possibility for a showdown here without a clear, without a predictable outcome.
Now, the president's approval rating tanked, and then the president came out with several speeches and a big propaganda war, really, in America, and the media cooperated nicely. Now he has a slight increase in support. But what will happen if he now has to explain that perhaps the head of the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean, was right, and the Iraq war is not winnable? Now, you mentioned that in your article. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I mean, this is, of course, the White House's problem. I mean, they can never admit that the war is not winnable. He has gone out so far on this limb that there is no way that he can crawl back. Any talks with the Sunni insurgents, will be presented as a way of, as part of a strategy of defeating. And no matter how odd that may seem to the reality-based community, that is indeed the way the White House will play it. I can guarantee you that. I mean, they are totally committed, as we now know, to a strategy, a political strategy, that is based on continuing to repeat as often as the president has an opportunity to repeat it, the big lie that we are winning and that we will win. And so whatever he does, including those moves that are the very opposite of that, in substance, will be presented within the context of that propaganda theme that we are winning and that we will win. And when he finally reaches an agreement with the Sunni insurgents, which I think ultimately he will have to do, he will present it as a victory. And I would suggest that there is in fact a historical precedent for this, and that is Richard Nixon negotiating with Hanoi, with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in 1973, a peace agreement which Nixon presented to the American people as a victory. And in fact, it was not a victory at all. It was a compromise which ultimately could not result in the U.S.-supported regime in Saigon prevailing, but was most likely to result in something other than that, either a mixed result of a sort of coalition government or a communist victory. So, I mean, this is the way these wars are ended. They are ended with a compromise which is presented to the American people as victory.
A lot to think about. Gareth Porter, thanks so much for joining us on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Gareth Porter is author of Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam, published by California University Press in June. You can read more of Gareth Porter's work online at ipsnews.net or Foreign Policy in Focus, fpif.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussion of this broadcast. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Radio.